Good afternoon. Welcome to this sixth edition of the IDEM Festival. We are very fortunate this year to have the artist with us. Her name is Noraci Palmieri. We have her show, hashtag punk, on Wednesday the 11th and Thursday the 12th at 10. Well, we have Nora with us, and we want to thank her for being here with us. So thank you, Nora. She is a choreographer, she's a performer. She also studied law. She lives in Brooklyn, in New York. And, well, we could say that she is a bit European, almost fully European, because she's all over the place, all the time, here and there, from one theater to another, from one festival to another. So, yeah. And she's an artist. She's in high demand. Everybody wants her. And it's a pleasure and an honor to have her with us, to share with us her experience and her work. Nora's work is energetic and provocative. She is an expert in stressing the limits, pushing the limits. And her work, one of the lines of work she does is confronting us against stereotype, racial and gender stereotypes, pushing us to the depths of that confrontation and to the complexity of that confrontation.
It's such an honor to be in this amazing space, and also a little bit terrifying, I have to say. I'm a little bit frightened, because I hope that we do deliver. I hope we bring the work as fiercely as we always bring it everywhere. But thank you for coming tonight, and thank you again, Marissa, and for the festival for inviting me and my colleague. And I also want to just take advantage and introduce my right hand, Papa Ibrahim Njai Kaolack, who does the work with me. So I could talk about many things. There are so many things to talk about, but perhaps it would be easiest for me to talk about the work, to talk about the background of hashtag punk, which is the work you will see tomorrow and the night after. Hashtag punk, as in the hashtagging generation, you hashtag everything. So essentially, with that title, I was hoping that everybody hashtags the fuck out of that. okay, so it just rolls over into everybody's psyche, and I think in some ways it has done that. Punk, because the word punk is not only about the sound, which people attribute to skinny white boys, English boys, but also it's an old word going even before the sound, which just meant you were just wrong. If you are a punk, you were just wrong. It has other sexual connotation too. You're just a punk ass, you know. So it's a word that is loaded with some other polluting ideas, which I think is quite good for the sound, which is punk. I wanted to interrogate and use this kind of nasty word. Also, by the way, punk has become super, super commercial. It's no longer what it used to be in the 60s, 70s, where it was dirty, it was bad. Now everybody wears ripped t-shirts and it's hyper cool. That's not the punk that I'm interested in. I'm interested in the bad, in the margin. I'm interested in the punk that used to be scary, that nobody wanted to associate with, that if you punked somebody, this was a fighting stance. This would create, you know, something rather unpleasant. punk, for me, is a refusal. I defined both the sound and the ideology as a refusal. That the skinny white boys did refuse. They could see that the future was essentially fucked up. I'm gonna be using bad language because I'm a punkster myself. We don't have to be nice and proper, or do we? Right? They could see that the future was getting more and more fucked up. It is, right? yeah, let's go for it. And so they wanted to refuse some of the the power that was going into state institutions, and they could see that they were not going to get jobs. And in the 60s and 70s is a collusion of certain things happening in England. The Commonwealth, the so-called Commonwealth, which is the British Commonwealth, India, Africans, the Caribbean, they're all being brought into London or to England to work as cheap labor. So punk is really a result of this urban kind of collision of the empire with England. And so I'm interested in this understanding of how punk emerges. So it's not only a product of angry, skinny white boys who couldn't think their way into their future, but it is a collusion of the Caribbean, of Africa, and India. At the same time, you have the development of the Sound Clash, which, if you wanna, that's the black side of the do-it-yourself ethos, the do-it-yourself ideology. The sound system that the Caribbean, particularly Jamaican young men were repurposing speakers and using science and basically joie de vivre intelligence to repurpose objects and make them what we now consider a classic. Like, I don't know where we would be without the dub sound. Without the science of reducing sound to just a baseline. You know, but these developments are happening at the same time, and they're not separate from one another. I mean, you can look at the Specials, you can look at, you know, blacks and whites are in the same band. People are going from a dub session to a punk session. You know, so I'm interested in this kind of undertold, I would say perhaps there are other people in the world who have thought about the emergence of punk as a result of this, of the empire, basically, as a result of the empire. And I would say Kodjo Eshun, who wrote this magnificent book, which should be on everybody's shelf, who's a self-respecting musicologist or whatever, more brilliant than the sun, Kodjo Eshun. He's got other books and other things that he's written about, and he's just a thinker, a magnificent thinker of our times, and must be read. Okay, so I'm interested in not only this history of what is happening in England, but how some of this is also trickling to my part of the empire, which is Zimbabwe, then called Rhodesia. So I'm born in 1965. I know, I look hella fine, right? As I say, in America, black don't crack. translation, black doesn't show age. but in 1965, the Rhodesians, working on behalf of their queen, or against their queen, declare themselves independent and call themselves Rhodesia, whereas it was called Southern Rhodesia before that. Then it becomes Rhodesia. So I am born right at the time where, you know, the settler colonialists are having a fucking good time, it seems. And then it is also the time when Chimurenga, the revolution in Zimbabwe, the second revolution, to refuse foreign rule, to refuse this invasion by foreigners, starts also about the same time. So I'm interested in how a kid, an African child, girl child, growing up in Mutare, then Rhodesia, you know, is affected, influenced by this do-it-yourself aesthetic, do-it-yourself. I would say also, for the most part, most Africans I know are punks, even though they wouldn't probably use the word, because we are very good at doing it ourselves. We're very good at repurposing and doing and just getting up and do it for ourselves. However, we are not very good at the commercial side of that. So in my work that you will see here, I'm interested in this African, this African in Europe, this African in America, this African in Africa. I'm interested in where we are right now, where there is a huge anti-African, anti-black sentiment, both in the capitalist world, basically, that the feeling is Africa should go back to Africa. And I like to use this provocation that I think when you do see us walking down in your streets in Europe, there is this feeling of like, yo, Africans go back to Africa. So then I try to use this feeling as a way to make an introduction. So my punk is about this. You feel that Africans should go back to Africa. But so how do we start a conversation around this? Since the 1500s, we've been tied to the hip, Europe and Africa. And since 1884, basically, you know, we've been tangoing together. How is it that now we're being asked to go back to Africa, and yet, you know, we've been cleaning your toilets ever since you can fucking remember? So I'm very much interested in the political economic conversation between the black body and the European body, and some of the philosophies that go around to try and support why Africans and all black bodies are not welcome. Oh, they're welcome for only specific things. So an introduction. So how do we make this introduction? So we start off saying, okay, Europe, this is an introduction. We're gonna make an introduction from Africa, anywhere Africa, because also people are retarded. They think it's one country. So it doesn't matter. It doesn't actually matter. It could be Brooklyn, Africa. In fact, Brooklyn is Africa. Because if you're black, it's just Africa. You know, it could be Suriname, it's Africa. So how do we make this introduction from anywhere Africa? You know, and it keeps coming back. This is an introduction, but we can't ever get beyond trying to make an introduction. Like, you know, we don't get beyond the how do we make an introduction? So part of my hashtag punk is this concern: how can we make an introduction? You know what you know, I know what I know. What I know is Europe owes me money. I'm interested, when I say this is an introduction, I'm interested in the question of reparations. Could it ever be repaired? How much? What does it cost for what had been stolen, taken, and continues to be stolen, taken from Africa and the black bodies. So this is an introduction, as I don't know how those motherfuckers were sent around at the Berlin Conference in 1884, you know, the 15 European countries, they were like, okay, we're gonna scramble for Africa. You know, how they, hello, I'm Sir Churchill, la 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 la, I'm gonna take this river. You know, what was that kind of introductory session like? I'm interested, I'm very curious. So then I also try to pull into the conversation icons of the Western canon, the Western canon. And I consider Patti Smith to be very much entrenched in the Western canon. No disagreements, right? Right, we agree. She's important, relevant, essential. So Patti Smith in the 70s, 78, she penned a song called Rock and Roll Nigger. So I'm trying to make an introduction and I say, well, yeah, I'm a rock and roll nigger, what are you? You know, so I've kind of, I'm gonna use a word that many people like to use, black folks like to use, but they use it almost as a weapon, appropriation. You're just appropriating our shit. Or at least in the Americas, this word is a fighting word, like, yeah, appropriation. Perhaps appropriate, or cite, maybe it's a better word, cite, a citation, Patti Smith, rock and roll nigger. And of course, she's also gotten into trouble many, many times around the word. I don't know which one is more troublesome, rock and roll or nigger. I don't know. But the combination of the two is perhaps kind of useful to also remember that there was a time when rock and roll itself was bad. And the word nigger continues to be a fighting word. And I don't use it lightly. So 1978, rock and roll nigger. And she has a refrain that says, outside of society, they're waiting for me. Outside of society, you know, kind of goes like that. They're waiting for me. So return back to the introduction. I'm a rock and roll nigger because, yes, I do feel outside of society, and I do feel that somebody is waiting for me. And I don't mean me, Nora Chipamir, I mean all of us. Anybody who considers themselves to be in the margins and all trying to do or say the right thing, I am sure that somebody is waiting around the corner for us. And in that same poem/song, she goes on to say, Jimi Hendrix was a nigger, Jesus Christ, and grandma too. Jackson Pollock was a nigger. Nigger, 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 nigger. So of course I love that she conjures up, as I'm conjuring her up, citing her to kind of make my introduction to you all, to everybody, that she conjures up Jackson Pollock as well as Jimi Hendrix. What's there not to like? What's there not to like? I go on to cite again Patti Smith, another song of hers, Gloria, which she wrote in 1975. In Gloria, she says, Jesus died for your sins, but not mine. So I take this text and I murder it. I murder it, kill it, in other words. I say, Jesus died for you, whitey, but not for me. Because When you met us, you brought either the Bible or the bullet. We had no prophet called Jesus. And I don't know, my fellow Africans, you know, they are gung-ho about Jesus right now. Christianity is big time. They're also gung-ho about Jesus' first cousin, the prophet Muhammad. None of these prophets have anything to do with me. And if they die, they didn't die for me. And I'm happy to repeat that again and again. And also not give a fuck if it's blasphemous. Because what we're trying to do here is shake up the energy so we can all start thinking, you know. In 1884, when certain gentlemen sat around and pulled people apart, they were not thinking, oh, this is blasphemy, right? They were not thinking, this is bad, what we're doing. They're thinking, oh, well, I mean, first of all, they're not even humans. Which returns me to this whole thing of Africa, go back to Africa, which is something that actually did happen to me in California, Oakland, California, which is rather a revolutionary place itself because the Panthers grew up there. But there I was walking down the street, you know, and then somebody said, get the fuck out of the way, nigger. And I was like, oh shit, I'm not a nigger, I'm an African. So I'm interested in interrogating this internally, the questions of the refusal of the word nigger, but also the fact that I can accept the word Africa, which is also made up. To be African is an idea. It's an idea. It really doesn't exist. There is no such thing. What else can I tell you about my provocative text? Jesus died for your sins, Whitey, but not for mine. With this shift of Patti Smith's text, I am trying to refer to my growing up during the apartheid that the Rhodesians imposed, that the Africans were separate, utterly. I didn't know any white people until 1980. 1980 is independence. So desegregation happens. It means that African kids can go to schools with white kids and white kids can go to school with African kids. So we can start to interact on that level and not just be as their housekeepers or their garden boys, which they still call us garden boys or house girls. Not in that working condition. Jesus died for your sins. I jump a little bit forward into the 80s, which, of course, Zimbabwe becomes independent in 1980. But in the 80s, we have major players such as Ronald Reagan, such as Margaret Thatcher. These characters changed the world. So whatever independence we thought we was getting in Zimbabwe was going to be immediately shaped by these two people, Mrs. Thatcher and Mr. Reagan. So Jesus did die for their sins, but not for me. So Patti Smith also says, so I've been, you know, you can tell I've been really studying Patti Smith here. She also says in some other texts, probably related, she says she doesn't give a darn about the past, but she fucks with the future. I say, okay, I give a damn about their past. Because whether it's the 1500s or the 1600s, when the Portuguese, and some of you Spanish, you know, you played a big part in this navigation of the seas, discovering new worlds. Courageous motherfuckers, that's all I can say. But I give a damn about the past, because that past has formed this character. Could we even imagine if there wasn't this clash between Europe and Africa, and the subsequent buying and selling of black African bodies? So I do give a damn about the past. I also give a damn about the present. Whichever present we're talking about, it could be crocodile presents. I don't know if you know what I mean by Mr. Crocodile. But I also fuck even harder with the future. No idea who the crocodile is. The crocodile is the current president of Zimbabwe. The past one who died, God rest his peace, 2-3 days ago, was called Bob, the dictator. The current one is called the crocodile, Mr. Mnangagwa. So I do give a damn about the present. We do have to care about it. I do have to care. We all do have to care. But I'm going to fuck even harder with the future, Miss Patti Smith. She says she fucks with the future, but watch me fuck with the future. Because I do believe that Africa is the future. In spite of everything, Africa is the future. We have the technologies and the understanding. When you're all trying to save, you know, gorillas and all elephants, I think we should be saving humans. So finally, if I'm unable to fuck with the present, the past, and the future, I'm just gonna use that most magnificent of the African technologies. I'm gonna voodoo the shit out. I'm gonna marabute this shit. Come on, Africa, now. We've known how to fucking fuck shit up. Let's do it. It's time. So, but things haven't failed yet. But the punchline is, if we can't do this, fucking with the present and the future and the past, we should voodoo this shit, which ties us back to Mr. Jimi Hendrix. We're voodoo children, but we can voodoo this shit. We can punk this shit. Going back to that moment of refusal, we can do it ourselves. We don't have to follow our parents. We don't have to follow the government. We can do it ourselves. So punk, hashtag punk, is a refusal, is an attempt to make a manifesto that says people of reason, a better reason, we can do this. We can punk shit up. We can create better futures. And let's do it. Let's do it. Let's do it. Maybe I'll stop there. Is that all right? And ask maybe Marissa can you know, like let's talk. Let's talk.
¿Alguien tiene alguna pregunta para Nora?
Are there any questions for Nora?
Hola, buena.
Hello. I love that an artist like you is doing politics, because artists today don't do politics, and I love that. You are a great artist doing politics. A question. When you are performing, what's the difference if you are performing for an African audience or a European audience. Is there any difference in your performance?
That's a great question. Thank you. And thank you for calling me a great artist. My performance and my my team, so Papa Ibrahim and Jai, and we have a punkster, Dave Gagliardi from New York, who plays guitar. Our performance wants to stay the same regardless of the audience. However, the audience is shifting. Of course, as living organisms, we are touched by how the public is reacting. The African audience listens physically. They don't, you know, if things are good, they react. Which I think is a listening that is kinesthetic, that is muscular listening. If it's bad, they fall asleep or they leave. The complete opposite of a European audience, which wants to listen sitting still, if there's any gesture, and then there's applause at the end. I actually think these are very, very weird differences. I think most Europeans would like to be free of this stereotype. I love stereotypes. Would like to be free of this stereotype because you have muscles, you can feel, you can think. However, there is a tradition going back to Louis XVI, the professional concert stage, where this becomes about class, so that the people who are going to consume concert art were the bourgeoisie, right? And they could do no better because they were basically inactive, and they continue to be inactive. They don't exercise, they don't do anything. So they just sit and clap their hands. The working people, however, are physical. That's the nature of the working class. So I think perhaps that could be the truer reason for the difference. That most Africans who show up to the work come from a working background, which has physical resonance. And they're constantly reacting in this way. As well as I do think that, you know, we do listen physically. I mean, think about it. The ear is not like a separate gadget over there, you know. And this division between the head and the body is a false division.
Are there any other questions? I would like to ask you if you think that through art, physical art, such as your art, you can change minds so that minds understand what we go through, Afro-Americans or Africans. Because I am an artist and I try to do it on stage, but often I have the feeling that they don't understand. They just don't understand seeing a black body doing things. And I don't know, it's just a question. As a young artist,
You can't be pessimistic as a young artist. courage, determination, art for life, not for this moment, or to be a celebrity. And you must know from experience already that we're not in it for money. So, I think on the contrary, I think the contrary, that there is actually an understanding. Perhaps the understanding is loaded with fear. I come to Europe knowing that Europeans have some understanding or an imagination of the black body. They cannot help it. So I use this fear. I use this tension. It's historic, it's physical. You walk down the street, people look at you a certain way. There is already tension. We are constantly in performance, brother. Any black body, the only time maybe you're not consciously performing is if you're in Africa, because there's so many of us, everybody's performing, nobody's looking at each other. But in Europe, you are in performance all the time. So to bring awareness to this fact that you don't need to do more to be in performance to get a kind of regard. So I'm not really concerned if the regard is good or bad, but there is a regard. You cannot regard, there is a look, there is a tension. And we can't ignore this tension. So as long as I am here and you are there, we are in this conversation. I do believe that the physical act is so fundamentally important, that the human organism is a living organism. So this shifts me to talk about the practice and the process that we do as a daily practice to protect and build our bodies. We feel each other. We feel each other. So maybe Europeans are stuck, some of them, not all of them, are stuck in the head, in this Cartesian divide, reason versus non-reason, apparently. But we know better. The whole body is an intelligent organism. It is thinking. So whatever you do, if you do it with conviction, it touches somebody. And you better believe that. It may just touch them in the way that they didn't expect or you didn't expect. The human body is powerful. And that's why it's so regulated. There are so many laws that regulate it because of its power. I'm just old enough to recognize that. So I try to be fearless. And even when, you know, sometimes we're in difficult situations, really, where we're the only black bodies and there's a sea of white people and you're like, smash your brain. You're like, por favor. No reaction. But I think even this lack of reaction is a reaction. You know, maybe the thing is so strong, it's just shut them down. Like, you know. So basically, I think as a young artist, you can't give up, and you have to know that this is not about money, and there is no Superman who's going to come to save you. You have to save yourself by your intelligence and your sincerity. No Superman is coming to save artists, basically, of any color for that matter. Let alone the black ones.
Hello. I was wondering. About the pain. I mean, suddenly I get super surprised how to handle pain and humor. It was this relationship around pain and humor, around bodily pain. I mean, completely this of I'm a dancer, it hurts in the sense, but the pain also, that pain, it's cellular, but it's also the pain. I don't know, the pain.
The pain. The and, pain.
Yeah. And humor. I don't know. There is something.
I think I understand in this way. I don't think maybe I understand fully, but I think Richard Pryor. Do you know who I'm talking about? Richard Pryor. Google him, y'all. Richard Pryor. Who's perhaps one of the greatest comedians, banal, the pain and the humor. We have to lace the pain with humor. And I would take humor to mean love. That the opposite of pain is love. We can't do this without love. It's because we love so much and we feel so deeply the pain, but they're kind of inseparable. It means you're living, you're feeling. There are people who have no sensibility. You can zzz, nothing. If you feel the pain, you are living. The organism is a living organism. You know, like the plants, you know, if you don't water them, it's the same thing. This is a living entity. For some of us, we go out into the sun, we make vitamin D. I'm telling you. Right? It's living, and you feel the effects of the lack of the sun, in fact. The sunflower, that marvelous plant, opens to greet the sun and just shines. So don't be afraid to feel, yo. There's nothing wrong with pain. There's nothing wrong with it unless it's debilitating. You know, the physical pain, well, if you go to the gym, it's probably, you know, you work out and you feel the lactose, you know, the buildup. It's good. It reminds you that you're living. The humor releases some of that built up lactose acid. We have to laugh. The world is full of bad things. I mean, you can't be from Zimbabwe and not have a sense of humor. You can't be African and not have a sense of humor. You can't be queer and not have a sense of humor. Because if you don't allow yourself to laugh at the absurdities, then you're dead. You're the living dead. I don't know if it answers your question. I suspect there's more to it. You know, maybe you want to talk about white guilt. Well, feel it. am I optimist or pessimist? See? Ah, yo habla español, dede. I think I have to be both. I think, you know, there is a whole discipline. I have to say, everything black is in right now. People, if you haven't heard, everything black is in right now. We have amazing thinkers, philosophers, Fred Morton, Hortense Spillers, Sidia Hartman, some girl De Silva from Brazil. We're killing it. Ça c'est la vérité. We're killing it in terms of really bringing an interrogation, philosophical, intellectual interrogation to what it means to be black African now. And so some people are so pessimistic that they think, you know, the black body is doomed because they cannot see an end to this relationship with capital. And some people are hopeful. I'm kind of swimming in between. Some days are good, I feel very, very pessimistic. And some days, you know, are better, and I feel optimistic. But I think the practice with the body allows some of us physical entities to move through it. So as long as the organism is healthy, it's all good. The organism has to be healthy. Has to be healthy. And it's good.
Hola, Nora.
Hello, Nora. It has been a pleasure to listen to you. I would like to ask you to tell us about your initial part of your career, your beginning as an artist. Did you study dance? Were you interested in other arts? Or, sorry, I'm asking you so many questions. I don't know your background. So, and where did you study? Did you study in Zimbabwe or in New York? And how did you think that would be the best way to communicate doing the type of performance you do with dance? Did you try with other arts? Yeah, that's it. Your beginnings as an artist. When did it wake up in you the need to communicate with the audience or the need to contact citizens?
Yeah, thank you. That's a question I get asked very often. Because if you read my biography, it says I graduated with a degree in law from the University of Zimbabwe. So how do you go from law to these kinds of advocacies, which I do consider the way, the work that we do, advocacies, we're advocating for an end of the world as we know it and a beginning of another world. How did we get here? How did I get here? I think a typical, if you look at many African artists, including my brother here, we don't come from what you would consider in the West programs. We don't study. We don't go to art schools. Dance classes, what is that? Most African artists who are working in the scene do not have this kind of classical European background. And I would be similar to Salia Sanu, the Burkinabe, was a policeman. I'm telling you, we all come from, you know. But what we have in common is the fact that our cultures are physical and celebrate physical expression. So we are never dissuaded from the physical expression. So I knew how to dance from the day I was born. And only now as a serious researcher, sorry Concha, you're too loud in my ear. So I was always dabbling in expressive things, but also as an African child in the Rhodesian system, art was not a word that I could have ever even encountered. None of my parents, it seemed to me, were artists. My mother didn't finish high school. She had a first child at 15. My father was a rural school teacher. By that, it means he went up to Form 2. He finished high school and did 2 years after that and went to a teaching college. and became a teacher in the village. So yeah, how do I get to here? So I can't say that I'm genius. I have to believe that it was always there. However, the trajectory into law school taught me how to think. And really, what do lawyers do? They perform arguments in costume, especially the British type. The courtroom is a theater. That was one thing that I really enjoyed about studying law. The other thing that I enjoyed was this idea of advocating for something. However, it did come to a head because I was, from high school onwards, I was a radio DJ, then I became a club DJ, Lulu. So all the time in high school and going to university, I was actually a DJ. I didn't get good grades at the fucking law thing, y'all, because I was partying and bullshitting. And the law thing was like, and also it was Roman Dutch law, which is, you know, colonial law. It's like, it's boring as fuck. Anyway, but I did manage to graduate. And as soon as I graduated, I decided that I should follow these other extracurricular activities as DJing, modeling, fashion, which I was hella into, and I was kind of doing relatively well in. All these things are performances. So then I moved to America because I was also doing some television. I was, you know, in Harare you could do anything. You know, in the 80s we were free as fuck. We had kicked out Whitey. We felt ennobled, empowered. I was the generation of the independent. I was one of the first to go to the University of Zimbabwe right after independence. So nobody could touch us. We were the coolest motherfuckers. Bob Marley had come, sang us, right? So I have to admit that I think other Zimbabweans after me, after the 2000s, don't have this feeling, this hubris, that we can do it, and we did it, and also I could do anything. So when I moved to America, I was really intent on becoming a Zimbabwe Spike Lee. So basically, I'm trying to find a language with which to speak. It takes the form of cinema, it takes the form of fashion, and I kind of fall into dance accidentally. I really wasn't looking for the dance, I just fell into it accidentally. But because I was really kind of good at dancing, and the first class that I took, kind of just as a way to do exercise, was a Martha Graham class. I was like, Lord, shit. Contract, release, contract. And then I kept asking, so when are we gonna dance? We've been contracting and releasing for hours. Can we dance now? So in this question, are we ever going to get to the dance? I was already asking a super, super critical question that goes to the heart of who I am. You know, if you call this dance and I'm not feeling it, what is my dance? What is my dance? But I liked Martha and Doris and all these other, the moderns, the women who created the American dance. I liked them for this reason. A, they were women. I think women can. And two, I thought, What are they really saying? They're expressing their inner landscape. Wow. This is why I wanted to make films and be like Spike Lee. I want to express my inner landscape. So that question led me back to Zimbabwe to find my dance. Yeah, that's how we get to here.
Hi, thank you so much for coming. So I just have a question that I, since you said it, since you were answering that the young artist over there, you mentioned that being black, especially in a white space, you're always performing and you're always performing. And that is something that I relate to very so much, and I kept thinking about it, and it's something that is exhausting to me. I've been living in this country for 5 years. I'm from the US and I studied architecture, and I'm always in white spaces. I'm always the black girl. And it's exhausting to be always watched, always having people look at you, and always the whole thing. And I wonder, since you're doing this art and you're sort of performing and you're showing off and you're trying to send a message, do you feel exhausted through your work? Do you feel like you're revived after showing your work? What's your experience? Do you feel exhaustion in your regular life, and your art is what kind of gives you back life? Is it the other way around? I wonder about your experience.
Yeah, I have stopped minding what other people are. So the work gives me life. I think maybe this answer is true for all people who use the body, because the reason we move, it regenerates the cells, you know. So we are constantly replenishing the organism, you know, keeping it alive and kind of vital and healthy. So the work is life-given. I don't feel exhausted because I also tapped into something that is maybe not particular to all black, but is very particular to the African black, which is the ancestor. That's my prophet. Call that motherfucker all the time. I don't do this work alone. I think it would be exhausting to not conjure up this animist space of like, I'm not alone, and so therefore I'm always protected. The performance spaces are also very temporary. They're temporary spaces. We don't have to sit in them for 5 years. We're here for 3-4 days, and then we move on to the next. So everything is constantly shifting. And the places that we do call home, between Brooklyn and Harare, they are super black. You know, so there is less of an exhaustion there. What is exhausting is trying to cross the border. I think we feel very exhausted there, and very much, what's the word, like the profiled. So sometimes we play up that profile too. Like, what, you just big now because I'm black? You know, and try and enjoy some of the bullshit, basically, and not take it to heart. But I'm also running with some serious motherfuckers who've got my back. We've got each other's back. So we're like, we're beyond a tribe. We're the mafia. So I would say, yeah, maybe we are less exhausted because, you know, we go like this, you know, this together, this separate, this together. And you know that this becomes, that's the propaganda, right? Yeah, so I would say maybe these are some of the ways that we are constantly trying to find to protect ourselves, sustain. We laugh about everything. The team is international. They're Jews, they're Africans, they're, you know, but there is this concept of solidarity. Some people who are Jewish read as white, and they are also kind of assaulted sometimes, like, how can you put up with this? And they're like, how can you not put up with it? You know, so I don't know if that answers your question, but I'm 54 years old. Do I look it? I'm having a fucking good time.